No one plans for hair loss, but through Hims, you can take the next step with confidence. Access treatments made with clinically proven ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil to stop hair loss and regrow hair in 3 to 6 months. No waiting rooms, no hoops, just ingredients with a track record of results. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you, with 100% online access to personalized treatments that put your goals first. For simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, ED, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/Hail Mary. That's hims.com/Hail Mary for your free online visit. hims.com/Hail Mary. Individual results may vary, based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Hey, it's Gary. This episode includes a discussion of Deshaun Watson. Much of it is not suitable for young listeners. For those of you who are sticking around, enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Podcast. I'm Gary Brandling.
And I'm Connor Orr.
All right, Connor, here's the deal with this show. We are going to talk about Dolphins 49ers coming up on Sunday. We are going to talk about Mahomes' Chiefs, Burrow's Bengals in the AFC title game rematch. We're even going to talk a little bit about Jeff Saturday from Monday night, because we don't get to cover that on our Monday morning show, because that's just the way time marches forward. But we are starting with Deshaun Watson's return to the field coming up in Houston, 1 o'clock Eastern time on Sunday. And we are going to talk about the on-the-field stuff and what we might expect in this game for a guy who obviously hasn't played in a very long time. But I kind of think we once again have to start with the off-the-field stuff. And I know a lot of you have heard this quite a bit, and perhaps there's a little bit of fatigue setting in, but Watson did not talk to the media on Wednesday. We are taping Thursday morning. It sounds like he is going to address the media at some point in the locker room on Thursday. But there are a lot of folks out there still kind of making the argument that, like, well, you know, we've done this 100 times. Watson doesn't have to say anything. And we're not at that point. He still does have to address this in some significant way, which he has not done.
Right. And I'm going to get to that in 1 second, Gary, but I do want to take just a second to compliment. You had a very lyrical opening to this show. Like, it was very good. When you were introducing all the things that we were going to talk about, I just want to, you should take a second to pat yourself on the back for that. It was really good.
Oh my goodness. Thank you.
It was like if you were a large Southern man, you'd be Keith Jackson. Like, that was, it was very Keith Jackson-y, you know? I really liked it.
That's what just, I aim for. I'm turning the page in December, doing Keith Jackson impressions from now on.
So yeah, everybody, there's a technical aspect to this. Everyone is saying, oh, let's move on. And not everyone. There are people who are saying, oh, let's move on. We've already done this. What does he have to do? Well, technically, by the letter of his suspension, he has to show some kind of contrition. He has to show that he's evolved, that he's learned something through this process. Because if he doesn't, if what we're going to see in a few hours is something completely egregious, or it's a double down on the blanket denial, which he's given in the past, the NFL reserves the right to be like, nope, okay, 11 more games, go back in the bullpen and let's try to figure this thing out. That has always been sort of the, you know, that's been the trap door in this suspension. At least that's what people in the NFL were saying to me afterwards, because everyone was upset. Mm-hmm. Not everyone. There were people who were upset about this not being a year-long suspension plus indefinite, which is what the NFL wanted. And what it, how was at least sold to me was it kind of is, because if he comes back out and acts the way he did before, then we just yank this thing and he goes back inside and he's got to figure this thing out. So yeah, I think today is a very big deal. I think today's a big deal. I think after his first game is a big deal. I think, you know, if you're a person in public, if you're a student of public relations, if you're the Browns' director of public relations, this is an all-timer in terms of how you handle this, how you coach him, what he's going to say, what he's comfortable saying. I don't know. I'm really interested.
Yeah, and just to remind everyone, going back to August, after the settlement of the suspension was announced, he was defiant. He continued to say he did nothing wrong. He had given a very strange, vaguely worded apology to kind of, you know, the world before the preseason game that he had played in. It was all very just awkward and difficult to understand. And then after the settlement was done, he came out and once again said, "I did nothing wrong." And of course, we've had Jenny on the show plenty. I've pointed back to our reporting from 2021 lots of times, but it is pretty close to definitive that he absolutely did many things wrong, and wronged many people in various ways here. As far as sort of moving forward, and again, I know a lot of people just want to watch football and enjoy football and its entertainment and all that stuff, and there are people who are lifelong Browns fans. Some of them have walked away from the team and found a new rooting interest or just no rooting interest going forward. And some people, you know, it's if you root for the Browns your whole life, it's kind of a difficult thing to shake it at this point, and it's irrational, and we all know fandom is irrational, and the tribalism that comes with it. We're rooting for a bunch of strangers because of the jerseys they wear, and that's just something we've kind of accepted as far as human behavior goes. But for some people, they're just not really able to disconnect from the team, and I thought Michael Rosenberg for us at Sports Illustrated had a really interesting piece that came out on Thursday morning about how we can't really make this a if you continue to root for the Browns, you hate survivors of sexual violence. We can't pit these two parties against each other because it's not only unhealthy, but it's really dangerous for women who have survived sexual violence.
Yeah, I thought that, and I mean, this is why Mike Rosenberg is our senior writer, columnist extraordinaire at Sports Illustrated. You know, he made me think of this in a way, and he was able to articulate it in a way that I just don't think I possess the skills to do. And that is, you know, he was talking to the director of the Rape Crisis Center in Cleveland. And her kids are Browns fans. You know, she grew up as a Steelers fan and watched what happened with Ben Roethlisberger and had to go through her own sort of internal checklist with, okay, the Steelers are in the Super Bowl. This guy stands against everything, you know, triggers horrible memories, experiences in the clients that I work with. This is bad, but, you know, this is the team I grew up with. This is, you know, I want to have these two different buckets in my life. And I think, in a lot of ways, not to broaden it beyond what's happening with Deshaun Watson, but we've always wanted sports in a separate bucket, but that became impossible in a lot of ways when, you know, you intertwine it with politics, when you intertwine it with something else. And I think that that's so much of the, and I'm not going to say I'm siding with anybody here, but that's the outcry that you're hearing from the other side, right? Is get politics out of sports. Get whatever Deshaun did out of sports, because sports is over here in this bucket. This is how I relate to my kids. This is how I hang out with my family. This is how I get my social, you know, my social experiences for the week, whatever it is. You know, this is what I look forward to. And then over here in this bucket are all the horrible things that happen in the world, and I can't have those two spilling into each other. And I thought that Mike did a good job of articulating that, where it's like, you know, yeah, we can acknowledge that we need these two things, these two different buckets, and also that we can't, what we can't do is we can't say, okay, you're either on the side of domestic violence survivors or you're on the side of the Browns. It's good versus evil. It's right versus wrong. This is the kind of thing that we've been doing with sports for the last, I mean, since 2016, right? You know, it's either you're for police or you're for the NFL. You're for Colin Kaepernick or you're for, you know, this is kind of the same version of what we've been trying to, you know, what we've accidentally been doing with sports, right? It's like we've been molding it into this kind of like cudgel to sort of like bang stuff with, you know?
And, you know, it's a larger societal problem that the NFL has so much sway over the way we think about things in larger society. Yes. and all of that. But it's also the reality of it. And again, just to bring it back to Watson and his public comments in August, you know, the NFL, they very much they're very earnest in their role in sort of being a leader in society. And again, it's a little bit absurd. It's more than a little bit absurd, but it's also a reality. And they wanted to come out of this saying, we are going to educate people about you know, sexual violence, and we are going to make the world better in part through this, not only, you know, punitive action against Deshaun Watson, but also the, you know, the rehabilitation we're going to do with him, and that's the way it's going to go. And, you know, they donated a certain amount of money to organizations who support survivors of sexual violence and educate people about it, et cetera, et cetera. Deshaun Watson coming out and defiantly saying, I've done nothing wrong, basically outweighs all of that. And that was the biggest issue there. There are so many people who will irrationally support him and probably would not really have a super strong feeling about, you know, women are lying. They're all out to get money and all that stuff. Some people are just going to lean that way, and that's the way it's going to go. But there are a lot of people who would not lean that way, who then hear the star quarterback for their favorite team say this sort of thing, not verbatim, but implied this sort of thing, and they are going to end up going in that direction, which is incredibly unfortunate, and that's the biggest issue. That's why not only does he have to show some sort of public contrition, both to, you know, number one, just the women who have shared accounts of his sexual assault or sexual harassment, not only to help them, but just to help women everywhere who have survived this sort of thing. But also, he's just, it's an opportunity for him. I think there is a belief in his camp that they can get back to the Deshaun Watson that everyone kind of loved back in, you know, 2020 and earlier. That's not going to happen. You can't get back to that place after you've done this sort of thing to this many people. What they can do is kind of say, okay, he recognizes what, you know, I, Deshaun Watson, recognize what I did wrong. And I'm going to have to be a better person. I can't undo those things, but I can rehabilitate myself. I can be a voice for making this better, making this world better in some way, shape, or form. And he just hasn't taken that opportunity.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what the right, wrong answer is. I just have never seen it go the way that I think Deshaun is hoping it will go, right? Which is just that
It's like, let's go back to November 2020.
Right. Or just almost like this whole thing is a sandstorm. Let's let it blow through, and then here I am afterwards, and we don't have to talk about the sandstorm. I'm still Deshaun Watson. And yeah. I just don't think – I mean – I know that we had a period of time societally where I think it was fashionable to just sort of bulldoze through opportunities to apologize and be like, I'm not apologizing. I'm not doing this. You know, this is who I am. This is a different situation, though. This is, you know, this is dozens and dozens of accounts of alleged sexual misconduct, assault. You know, you don't just get to say, no, I'm not doing that. This is something that I think that societally, fairly universally, there needs to be some sort of valley publicly that we need to see you go through before the ascent, you know? And again, I think that you and I, and I, well, I don't want to put words in your mouth. I think we are all, and we talked about this with Tyreek Hill. There are statistics that show, right, that just universally banning someone and disallowing them from coming back ever is a way bigger problem than, facilitating growth and legitimate need for contrition, you know? And So I think that, hey, if Deshaun Watson comes back and is a great quarterback and is apologetic and recognizes the damage done, okay. You know, it was obviously not ideal that we got into this situation. It was not great. But okay, there's a path out here. There's a way to go where we need to go. And so I don't know. I just think that, again, I was rambling a little bit, but I've never seen someone just keep that linear path through the controversy without sustaining more damage over time, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think there just needs to be, and I don't want to compare it to any other cases because this is different, it's unique, but when we're just talking about this sort of thing in general, like, you need to get broken down before you build back up. There has to be that process. And,
yes.
You know, I don't know. I could be wrong. I don't remember a time covering the NFL where a player was just like, nope, 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 and then just got through it.
Yep.
I don't.
There's a path to redemption. We've had a lot of people, you know, sort of say, well, what about second chances? Do you ban them for life? You don't ban them for life.
No.
And again, the whole thing that there's a lot, again, there's a lot absurd and silly about the whole process of the NFL sort of trying to land on a correct number of games that fits, this sort of offense. But it's more about what is going to get you back on the path to that second chance. And a lot of time there is some punitive aspect to that you have to serve. But the very first step on the path back to redemption, a path back to a legitimate second chance, which has to be earned, is even privately just acknowledging what you've done wrong. And it seems like he hasn't even taken that very first step. And that's the issue at this point. You haven't earned a second chance if you don't put in even the minimum amount of effort to get that second chance. Although, you know, again, we'll see what he says when he speaks publicly here. But, so far, he hasn't even started to work toward getting the opportunity to get back on the field. So the other obvious thing here is that Deshaun Watson is going to play in the NFL for the next decade plus, probably 10 to 15 years, and that will start on Sunday. And we will now discuss what to expect on the field. It's going to be about 700 days from his last start in the NFL. He's going out there against a Texans team that isn't very good, with a Brown supporting cast that is pretty good. New system, new supporting cast. What do you expect on Sunday?
So I wrote this, and I was thinking about this. This will be published tomorrow, so you know, when you guys you can find it on SI.com. But I kind of wrote a version of, sure, it's negatively slanted, but what if this doesn't work out? And I say it with full acknowledgement that it will probably work out. Deshaun is really good at mm-hmm. football. He
yep.
was probably, he's probably like the fourth or fifth best quarterback in the NFL before all this stuff happened, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Is that fair? Somewhere
yep.
around there?
I agree. Yep.
So my questions are, the NFL's changed dramatically in the last 700 days. I think it rewards much less quarterbacks who can extend plays and then make big throws downfield. I don't think that happens anymore. You know, mm-hmm. too high shell, has really sort of, unless there's coverage busts, which there always are, and there's always going to be big plays, but the idea that you're Ben Roethlisberger or you're Russell Wilson and you're just shaking dudes off in the backfield until someone gets open downfield doesn't really happen anymore. You put a hard cap on that, and you want teams to beat you via paper cut because they'll make more mistakes that way. I don't know if we've seen Deshaun play a ton of that style of football. I think, and we used to go bananas when Bill O'Brien overused him in the running game, and sometimes he had to, especially after Deshaun Watson tore his ACL. I think he's going to have to be more involved in the running game as a quarterback than he ever was, because we're seeing, you know, Jalen Hurts, in order to make some of the stuff that used to work now, there has to be such a pronounced run fake element at the line of scrimmage, and there has to be the threat that the quarterback is going to leave. That's true in Buffalo. That's true in Philadelphia. That's even true to some degree in Kansas City, where sometimes we'll see Patrick Mahomes just rip off 70 yards, and then teams are like, oh, crap, we forgot that he can do that. Let's readjust. So I do think that Deshaun's going to have to be more involved in the running game than he's ever been. I am interested to see what they run offensively because, again, in Houston, it was a lot of Clemson stuff. At least that's how I understood it, how coaches described it to me, right? They borrowed a lot from Clemson. They took a lot of what he liked to do there to make it comfortable for him. In 700 days, a lot of Clemson players have come to the NFL. A lot of that stuff, Tony Elliott, all that stuff has been baked into offenses. A lot of that stuff people know how to stop now, or at least, you know, they have an idea of how to stop. And the one, I'll close this Lincoln-esque diatribe by by saying, so I think about the run-pass option, right?
Mm-hmm.
When Deshaun left the NFL, that was still, it was on the tail end of unstoppable, right? Now, 700 days later, like the run-pass option has evolved like six times in order to even survive in the NFL. You have to, like the Eagles do run-pass-run, right? Mm-hmm. Or run RPRO, you know, and there's all these different layers to it now just to make it work. You see how much Aaron Rodgers struggles to do the quick game RPO, and Pat Mahomes, the quick RPO stuff is not there as much as it was anymore. At least I don't think so. And so the life cycle of stuff that was effective back in 2020 is just not there in 2022. So I think it's going to be interesting. If you're Kevin Stefanski, how do you scheme up the stuff that's going to keep him comfortable, that's going to get him out of the gate fast? Because some of that stuff that used to work doesn't work now. In addition, and I promise that was the last thing, but this is the last thing, and then I'll hand it back to you, Gary. It was a cover three league when Deshaun left. Yep. It is not a cover three league anymore. So I don't know. That's there's a lot of unknowns. He's probably going to be fine. Again, his athleticism, I think, negates a lot of the major shifts and puts the Browns in an okay position and the running game, right? I mean, you have these guys, you're probably going to be okay, but there's always a chance you're not.
Yeah, and look, very specifically with this matchup in Houston, and you know, there's going to be a, I don't know how it reacts to an entire stadium full of people. I mean, this is going to be a very ugly scene. Right. On Sunday. But as far as just the X's and O's matchup goes with the Texans, I mean, this is a really good matchup for the Browns, which shouldn't surprise anyone because of the Texans' record at this point. But the Texans, I think, lone strength on defense right now is the pass rush, and I think the Browns can handle that fairly well. You know, it's a fast-flowing defense that just it doesn't flow fast right now. It's just it's too young. It's too disjointed, way too many missed tackles on this team. There are just a lot of opportunities. I think the one thing that you'd worry about, and again, this is a very broad analysis of it, but just knocking the rust off, can you be precise enough? You know, as you point out, it's a split safety league. You have to operate with some sort of precision. Can you do that after not playing in a live game for 700 days? There's a lot more margin for error against this Texans defense right now. That's just the way it is, and it serves as potentially a pretty nice warm-up game here to sort of get his feet wet and get going here for the rest of the season, and maybe the Browns run the table and sort of get back into the playoff picture here.
I think no matter what, and I included this in the column because I just know how this is going to go, he might light it up. But the Texans are the worst team in the NFL. So let's allow ourselves to get a sample size here before we either thumb our nose at this or we say, now, if he comes out and plays horribly against the Texans,
then it's a red flag.
That's a red flag. Yeah. But my guess is if I had to lay down bucks on what I think the Browns are going to do, I think they're going to lean incredibly heavy on the running game. I think they're just going to hand it off. Put Deshaun in situations where, he's not going to have to convert a ton of third and longs. Even second and seven plus, I would guess that they're going to run the ball more than they probably normally do.
Mm-hmm.
Just to ease him into this thing. One interesting wrinkle, though, I was actually just thinking about this just now. Lovie Smith was at Illinois from 2016 to 2020. So the two of them missed each other entirely. So he might not have seen Tampa 2 before either. Now, I know some teams use Tampa 2, and I know that Lovie doesn't always run Tampa 2, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I think Sean might see a little bit of Tampa 2 for the first time, which is kind of interesting.
Okay.
I was Googling Lovie Smith to make sure I had the timeline right, and his first coaching job was at his high school alma mater called Big Sandy High School in Texas.
Oh, nice.
How cool is that?
Big Sandy.
The Big Sandy Wildcats.
Oof. I'm going to petition to rename all the schools in my town Big Sandy. Big Sandy Elementary, Big Sandy Middle School, Big Sandy High School.
Man, how tough would you feel coming on the field as a Big Sandy Wildcat?
Yeah. Let's hit two other games here on this show. Dolphins 49ers. I'm gonna start off on this one because this Dolphins offense is obviously really spectacular right now. It's wide open spaces. It's Tua throwing to space. It's some air raid concepts mixed in with Shanahan concepts, but in a good way. It's just really impressive what's going on there, and everyone's playing at a really high level. This 49ers matchup is interesting for a couple of reasons. I think more than any other defensive coordinator in the league, D'Amico Ryans does not fear risking giving up the big play. I think there are a lot of, and you've written about this, I think there are a lot of defensive coaches in the league who, more than anything, just want to avoid giving up the 70-yard touchdown and being embarrassed. I don't think that's in D'Amico Ryan's DNA. I think this is a very aggressive offense. They will, a very aggressive defense. They will blitz at times when perhaps you think they should not blitz, and I think that's going to provide something of a different look for Mike McDaniel and Tua Tagovailoa and the rest of this Dolphins offense. And the other thing here, and I mentioned this on the Monday morning show, obviously we didn't devote a ton of time to Dolphins Texans, and most of that time was spent mocking Kyle Allen. But Tua took a lot of hits in that Texans game. They did not protect him very well, and obviously this 49ers pass rush can wreck things. So a nice challenge here for the Dolphins after they have just really dominated some sort of second-tier defenses across the league.
Yeah, I wonder, and I think that the way that the Patriots played the Dolphins back in week one in the second half, mm-hmm. you broke the news of this. You were first on this, and then I went back and I watched it, and it was really, really cool. It was actually fascinating to watch. I think that was a blueprint game for the Dolphins, and I think this could be a blueprint game for the Dolphins in terms of how to defend them. We don't know. This is going to be the ultimate, and I hate, God, it's so cliche. Are there any other battles of wit other than a chess match? What else do really smart people do so we can stop saying that this is a chess match between Kyle Shanahan and Mike McDaniel?
It's a battle of sorry.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
Trivial Pursuit. I don't know. What's like a good, what do smart people do?
I don't know how to play backgammon at all. That seems like something smart people do.
My wife has offered to teach me multiple times. She's very smart, big backgammon person.
Yeah.
I just don't think I can handle it. I don't think I have the mental capacity. Okay. Do you ever play spinners?
No, I don't even know what that is.
Kind of like it's like a dominoes, sort of like dominoes a little bit.
Okay.
It's kind of like an offshoot of dominoes. Boy, I mean, go fish, you know?
It's a Pokemon Battle Academy thing.
Wow. I mean, I'm pretty good at that, but I'm not smart. Whatever it is, whatever you want to call it. I mean, if there's somebody out there who knows how to defend Mike McDaniel, it's going to be D'Amico Ryans. But if there's someone who knows how to gut D'Amico Ryans, it's Mike McDaniel. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I love talking to coaches about this because it's so interesting. The answer that I get from most people is that, hey, you have to accept the realities of the regular season. You have to go back to their last four games and you have to say, here's what they've been doing. Here's probably what they're equipped to do right now. Let's control what we can control and stop this. But with McDaniel on offense, I think there's a couple of guys, Mike McDaniel on offense, Bill Belichick on defense, Sean McVay, where they're going to pull stuff out of the hat from that they've never done, that they've done 10 years ago, that they did in college, Mike McDaniel ran at Yale. We don't know. And so I think that's going to be the cool part about this. My guess is that the 49ers are going to come out and just try to shove the ball down Miami's throat. They're going to try to limit possession, and they're going to go after Tua with everything they've got on every snap and force him almost the way I think they're afraid that teams will play Jimmy Garoppolo, and almost the way that the Patriots played the Dolphins, which is you flood the intermediate guys, and then you come after the quarterback. So you flood the check down options, you flood the motion guy out of the backfield, and there's different ways you can do it, and then you go after the quarterback, and you say, all right, you're throwing long, then you got to throw long now, and you got to be uncomfortable while you're doing it. I think that, to me, is how I would imagine this game gets played.
That's if I were game planning against the Dolphins, and I would do it horribly, and I'd give up 97 points. But I would force the one flaw you've seen with Tua's play this year is, you know, we all kind of like to, I don't know, joke, I guess, about the fact that his deep ball tails off and he underthrows receivers over the top. I would just make him throw over the top. I realize you're playing with fire because, you know, we've seen Tyreek Hill just have 20 yards beyond the you know, the deepest defensive back, and then it's a free touchdown. But I would make him make those throws because those are the throws that he has missed this year, where he has to throw over the top of a trailing defender and make him drop that in there and make him do it downfield. That's much easier said than done. They obviously have found ways to just blow open wide open spaces at the intermediate levels, and we'll see how the 49ers counter that.
Back to the second half of the Patriots-Dolphins game, because I can't stop talking about this. I've can't stop thinking about it. I watched that game like four times after you mentioned it on a podcast. And so one of the things that I thought was awesome was Belichick had his fastest guys on the field. And what he would do is when the Dolphins are going to catch you in the backfield with all this speed, with all the motion, they're going to put you in uncomfortable positions before the snap. Mm-hmm. And so what Belichick did was said, no, we're not doing that. We're not playing the game. We're not shifting with you. What we're going to do is, he had some of his fastest defensive backs in the box. And so let's say Tyreek Hill comes flying out of the backfield, and the defensive back would watch Tua. He'd have his eyes on Tua. And then at the last second, he would bail and start running after Tyreek just enough to undercut like a check down throw. And so it scares Hill or scares Tagovailoa just a little bit, and he's not going to throw that. Or what he did was, he would have a safety on the opposite side of the field come and take the motion guy after the snap. So you don't know who's guarding who. You have no idea who's matching up with who. It's almost like right before the snap, you're doing a little bit of fast break defense where it's like, okay, I got that guy, but yeah, you're not going to declare it at all. And so I thought that was fascinating and sort of jibes with what some coaches said, which is that in order to stop Miami, you have to or the Rams or any of these teams that rely solely on backfield motion, you have to freak them out at the snap. You have to do one thing that just scares them into saying, okay, we can't do this anymore, because then it's going to give us looks that we don't like and we don't want.
Yeah.
If you can force Miami to be a little more one-dimensional, I think that's the secret sauce. But again, so much easier said than done. Tyreek Hill is the ultimate exploder of all this.
And let's talk Chiefs-Bengals just a little bit. It's such a fascinating second half in the AFC title game, and obviously Kansas City now has to be ready for it, but it's also a different look for the Chiefs' offense this year. They don't have Tyreek Hill, the master exploder referenced in the previous segment. February at that point when they played, or maybe it was January, I don't know when it was, the AFC title game. It was winter. It was cold out. It was very cold. The issue the Chiefs had the second half was the Bengals were not just dropping seven, they were often dropping eight. Mahomes didn't have anywhere to go with the ball, and frankly, he needed to use his legs more often. He needed to run and take some of those opportunities to pick up, you know, 6-7 yards and move the ball that way, and he didn't, and that's why they didn't score until the very end of the second half there. So they should be prepared for it. I'm kind of curious to see how a Chiefs offense that's a little more equipped to be precise and to move the ball in an incremental way deals with the Bengals defense that obviously made them do it, and the Chiefs weren't able to do it last year.
This is all about, I feel like a broken record, but this year has been all about Patrick Mahomes' evolution. And I think the fact that he's on an MVP trajectory shows us that he has answered the call. This is a different offense. It forces him to be more precise sometimes. I mean, sometimes you're the Chargers and you just hand Travis Kelce the ball in wide open space for some reason and let him bang his way into the end zone. But there are other times when he has had to be more precise, more creative, more improvisational than he's ever been in his career, but also better on the timing stuff. And I think he's totally answered the call here. I think he's had a phenomenal season. I love the fact that you don't know where this Chiefs game plan is running through outside of the tight end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we could have a Juju Smith-Schuster 10-catch, 155-yard game and then never hear from him again. And I think that that is bad for certain teams. Like, you wouldn't want that if you're the Vikings. But I think if you're the Chiefs, it's fantastic, right? Because all these guys are capable of carrying the load for a game. And Patrick Mahomes is good enough to make it through those progressions and find the guy that is has the opening, right? Has the advantage.
You know what I think this game is going to be? And I'm going to annoy everyone and not predict a winner, but I think it's going to be really high-level quarterback play, which is not bold. I think it's going to be a lot of sustained offense and long time-consuming drives, and I think it's going to be one of those games where it ends up like 27-24, and then everyone says, like, oh, the game is only 27-24 with Mahomes and Burrow. But, you know, the games that tend to get into the, you know, 45-40 type of range usually involve, like, pick sixes and fumbles and lots of turnovers and lots of sloppy play, lots of incompletions to stop the clock sort of thing. I don't think you're going to see that. I think you're just going to see two teams clicking offensively, and the ball is going to move steadily back and forth and back and forth. And in the end, it's going to come down to a field goal by someone.
Interesting. I like that prediction. Who did you pick in the game picks, Gary?
You'll have to go to SI.com and contribute to our business.
There's a tease. Nicely done.
I honestly have no idea, though. I'd probably pick the Chiefs, if I had to guess. Let's wrap this one up. We did not have a chance to talk about this. Again, we tape our show Sunday night. It comes out Monday morning. The Steelers and the Colts played on Monday night. But obviously, Jeff Saturday, for the first time in his three-game coaching career, got a lot of heat for his performance on Monday night, mostly having to do with the Colts' final drive and the clock management. But I don't know. What did you take away from all that?
I'm not going to jump on Jeff Saturday because, you know what? He's been okay, right? In relative to our expectations. Our expectations were this was going to be complete bumbling chaos. the flow of the game was going to completely overwhelm him, and everything is sunk. There's a lot of coaches who mismanage clock. Andy Reid mismanaged clock for the first decade of his career, mm-hmm. to the point where it took him a Super Bowl before we forgot about the clock management thing. So I'm not going to jump on Jeff Saturday for that. If you want me to still jump on him for taking this job, I'm all for it. I can do another 45 minutes on that. But I think as a coach so far, it's a weird situation. And I think he's been largely okay. Like, I think game planning wise, they've been solid.
Yeah.
But I don't know how much that he has to do with. I don't know whether he's just popping into doors and being like, hey, guys, you know, I don't know what his involvement is, what his role is there. But the coaches are doing a heck of a job there. And okay. Yeah. You mess up the timeout thing. Okay. Were you going to score a touchdown there anyway? And I understand this is defeatist and it's not what, you know, Colts fans want to hear, but probably not. I mean,
yeah.
I don't see Mike Tomlin's giving up a touchdown at that point in the game, but I don't know. Matt Ryan was playing kind of okay, so possibly. He looks spry on that scamper, though, I'll tell you that.
He did. He had another one. I mean, Matt Ryan, start working with that sprint option in there. That's what Jeff Saturday's got to do. Yeah, I always say the worst thing a coach can do from sort of like a PR standpoint, from a public perception standpoint, is screw up clock management because, I play Madden. I can manage the clock in an NFL game. Maybe not under the pressure of, being on the sideline and a lot of people screaming at me. Maybe I choke under that, but I can recognize what bad clock management is. Most casual fans can. So when you do that, it's very easy for everyone to jump on you and say, you screwed that up, as opposed to, pointing out you should have given more disguised looks that rotated from cover two to cover three against Kenny Pickett, or whatever the actual criticism of that loss would be in the end. But my broader takeaway on Jeff Saturday at this point, I agree with you, it's been fine. I think if the owner was willing to kind of weather the early PR storm, I don't think any of this is going to knock him off course to make Jeff Saturday his head coach if that's what he wants to do. And I assume it's what Jim Irsay wants to do. So I think we're still moving on that path where, Jeff Saturday probably ends up getting the job at this point, unless it's like they go out there and they're losing games 48-2 the rest of the season. A lot of safeties.
That's what I thought was going to happen. And I don't know if I said this on the show or not, but after because I ripped the Raiders for losing and then to the Colts, and then the Colts almost beat the Eagles and almost beat the Steelers. And while the Steelers aren't good this year, I thought that it's a Mike Tomlin defense, right? And mm-hmm. it's still Mike Tomlin, right? So I think someone posed it to me this way. They said, were you mad? Were you so overcritical of the Raiders losing to the Colts because you thought it was an egregious thing in and of itself, or because you thought that Jeff Saturday was going to be way more incompetent than he actually was, and so the results surprised you? And so I don't know. It forced me to keep an open mind. I'm keeping an open mind now.
Yeah.
And I have nowhere else to put this, so I'm just going to put it here. Jeff Saturday, I thought he was the old, like, I saw him on the sidelines on Monday and I was thinking about it. When I saw that press conference, I was like, this guy's not going to wear a hat, because he's got such good hair.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about, how many NFL coaches don't wear a hat? And there's actually a sizable amount of guys who don't wear a hat. I didn't realize that.
Okay.
I kind of thought like all NFL coaches wore a hat, but then I did some research, started digging in, and I made what I think is a fairly comprehensive list of hat coaches and non-hat coaches.
Okay.
Do you want to take a run at the non-hat coaches?
The non-hat coaches. Okay.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's 11. But one of them is only sometimes.
See, the sometimes is what's gonna throw me. I'd like to know if there's anyone who never wears a hat.
So Lovie Smith I've seen with and without a hat. So correct. Let's take him out. There's 10 guys. 10 never hatters.
10 never hatters. Okay, let me think.
And visors don't count. And I want to make this a point because list.
Wait. Visors don't count as a hat?
Visor is a hat. A visor is a hat.
Yes, I thought you were saying the other thing. Okay.
Oh my God. I made this list and everyone's sending me pictures of Josh McDaniels and Dennis Allen and I'm saying, that's a hat. And they're saying, no, it's a visor.
Yeah, no,
covering your hair, and I was no, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. Not doing it.
Robert Sala.
Yes.
Okay, but that's the thing. Like I'm sure he wears like the knit hat when it's 25 degrees out.
Yes,
I would assume. Andy Reid wears a visor. Josh McDaniels wears a hat. Hackett wears a hat. Harbaugh wears a hat. Stefanski wears a hat. Tomlin wears a hat. Vrabel doesn't.
Vrabel is a non-hat guy, too.
Okay. We talked about Lovey. Peterson wears a hat. Sirianni. Does Sirianni? Huh.
He's a sometimes hat guy, but I put him under the hat guy category.
I think he wears a hat. I think he's.
I've
a
seen
hat
him
guy.
With and without a hat, but more so often with a hat.
McCarthy, Dable's not a hat guy.
Dable is not a hat guy. That's three.
Okay.
Except on the 9/11 tribute game, he wore an FDNY hat, which was very. Okay. It was a cool hat. I've tried to buy that. I can't find it anywhere.
Oh, that's weird. I think FDNY could cash in on that a little bit.
I think so too, but.
Let's see. Pete Carroll doesn't wear a hat.
That
hair is too good. McVay doesn't wear a hat.
Five.
Again, good hair.
So you're touching on a big theme here because you got to look at the good hair guys, you know?
Yep. Matt LaFleur. Does Matt LaFleur... Matt LaFleur wears a... I can picture him in a visor. He's a visor guy?
No hat guy.
Ugh.
So that's another one. That's six.
It's fine. I don't know if I've seen. I don't know if I've seen Matt Eberflus on the sideline at all this year. Show him. He is a hat guy.
He's a hat guy. Yep.
Bowles is a hat guy. Arthur Smith.
Hat guy.
Dennis Allen is a hat guy.
Visor guy.
Okay. Who did I not get? I'm Wilkes. I've only really watched one Panther game snap.
Steve Wilkes is not a hat guy.
Okay.
You miss Steve Wilkes. You miss Cliff Kingsbury, who is obviously not a hat guy.
Kingsbury was a visor guy.
No.
Oh. Okay. I'm going to review that after the show.
Hold on. No.
You're right. Okay. All right. You're right. He's a sunglass. The sunglasses were his thing.
Yes.
Right.
I was going to say, you going to put a lid on that thing?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good head of hair. And you missed Mike McDaniel.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay.
Mike McDaniel is a non-hat guy. I think that was it. It was Carroll, Dable, Wilkes, Kingsbury, LaFleur, McVay, McDaniel, sometimes Lubby, Vrabel, Sala. Oh, you missed the king of no hat guys. Bill Belichick.
But Belichick wears a visor sometimes.
Sometimes, but more often than not is a no hat guy.
Is a no hat guy? Okay. Yeah. I was going to say Belichick. I just figured it was too 50-50 at that point. If I'm Saturday's agent, I think he's a CAA guy. You got to get the Selsun Blue people in here, paying them some money. He's got to rival like Head and Shoulders. They own the airwaves. You can get Jeff Saturday in there.
Those are gorgeous locks. That's all I got to say.
They are
gorgeous.
As I said, good looking dude. The MMQB NFL podcast is Connor Orr and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody, and our senior podcast producer is Dan Bloom. Mark Ravitz is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Super Bowl champion Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts, and once you do, please leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.